just talking about it and talking about the story of how these people regarded the indigenous people as the devil incarnate, just logically, would they really be sitting down for Thanksgiving dinner with people they consider the devil, these true believers? I don't think so. If there were any Native people there, they would probably have been enslaved.
That's Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on the other side of Thanksgiving. The historical lens through which national holidays are viewed is often blurred and distorted. Thanksgiving is a case in point. The much-revered pilgrims, fresh off the Mayflower, sat down and shared native foods with the friendly Wampanoags. A heartwarming story. But this idea of the gift-giving Indian helping to establish and enrich what would become the United States is largely a myth. Native Americans would soon be overwhelmed and killed en masse by white settlers. Those that survived the murderous campaigns against them were relegated to inhospitable reservations. Indian land was stolen fair and square. Today we honor, in a twisted way, the memory of those slaughtered. With Apache and Black Hawk helicopters, Jeep Cherokees, the Washington Redskins, and calling Bin Laden Geronimo. Native Americans are offended by the appropriation of their culture. It is the final stage of genocide. Our guest today is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. She's the author of the 2015 American Book Award-winning An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Her expertise in ethnic studies, women's studies, the Sioux Nation, and other indigenous peoples of the Americas is recognized around the world. She spoke at Fairhaven College in Bellingham, Washington. And now, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
In 1970, on the 350th anniversary of the English settlers occupying the land of the Wampanoag Nation, United American Indians of New England led a protest of the Thanksgiving holiday, which they called a National Day of Mourning. Every year since that time, the National Day of Mourning has taken place at Plymouth Rock. They rightly accused the United States government of having invented a myth to cover the reality of colonialism and attempted genocide. The Calvinist separatists were actually hapless instruments of British colonialism. They also were the minority of the people who were on the Mayflower. The venture was financed by a corporation, the Virginia Company of London, to plant a foothold in that part of the Atlantic coast. But such colonial ventures were always controlled by military men. I call them mercenaries, who brought with them their previous war experiences in Britain's wars. Those who put together and led the first colonial armies, such as John Smith of Virginia, Miles Standish of Plymouth, John Mason of Connecticut, and John Underhill in Massachusetts, had fought in the bitter, brutal, and bloody religious wars ongoing in Europe at the time of the initial colonization in North America. John Smith of the Virginia colony, you know, the leader of the military contingent that founded Jamestown 1607, which is not much celebrated because it was too ugly to even think about celebrating. But John Smith also, he went back, fought some in Europe, and he came back on orders of the crown to map New England in 1614. In fact, he created that name, New England, in 1614. Soon after his military contingent's visit, a pandemic struck the indigenous farming and fishing villages where the Mayflower docked in 1620. It was no accident. It docked there purposely. It was prepared. The ground was prepared for the venture. Even before the Mayflower, King James praised God for, quote, sending this wonderful plague among the savages. Miles Standish, the military leader of the Mayflower Project, like Smith, had long practiced burning towns and fields and killing the unarmed and vulnerable. and tragically for the Indian people of the Eastern Seaboard, writes military historian John Grenier, the mercenaries unleashed a similar way of war in early Virginia and New England. But Thanksgiving became a holiday only during the Civil War. But neither Pilgrims nor Indians were mentioned in Lincoln's proclamation. Pilgrims made their first appearance in the triumphal 1890s, marked by the 1890 Wounded Knee Massacre, backdating the already existing origin story to symbolic first settlement. The core of the origin story that already existed by the 1890s was invented earlier. James Fenimore Cooper published The Last of the Mohicans in 1826, a bestseller throughout the 19th century, and has been in print continuously since, with two Hollywood movies based on the story, the most recent made in 1992, the time of the Columbus quincentenary. Cooper developed a fictional counterpoint of celebration to the dark underbelly of the new United States, the birth of something new and wondrous, literally the U.S.-American race, a new people born of the merger of the best of both worlds, the native and the European. Not a biological merger, mind you, but something more ephemeral involving the dissolving of the Indian. In the novel, Cooper has the last noble, as he terms it, and pure natives die off, as nature would have it, with the last Mohican handing the continent over to Hawkeye, the nativized settler, his adopted son. With mid-20th century development of multiculturalism, this origin story theme of the gift-giving native was further developed, crediting them with having contributed corn, beans, buckskin, log cabins, parkas, maple syrup, canoes, hundreds of place names, and even the concepts of democracy and federalism. But this idea of the gift-giving Indian helping to establish and enrich the development of the United States is an insidious smokescreen meant to obscure the fact that the very existence of the country is a result of the looting of an entire continent and its resources. Now, all modern nation states claim a kind of rationalized origin story upon which they fashion patriotism or loyalty to the state. When citizens of modern states and their anthropologists and historians look at what they consider primitive societies, they identify their origin myths, quaint and endearing stories, but fantastical ones, not grounded in reality. Yet many U.S. historians and other academics and politicians and people seem unable or unwilling to subject their own nation state's founding story to the same objective examination. The United States is not unique among nations in foraging an origin myth, but most of its citizens believe the United States to be exceptional among nation states. And this exceptionalist ideology has been used to justify appropriation of the continent and then domination of the rest of the world under the guise of manifest destiny, God's will. Although the U.S. Constitution represents for many U.S. citizens a covenant with God, the U.S. origin story goes back to the Mayflower Compact, the first governing document of the Plymouth Colony, named for the ship that carried the 100 or so passengers to what is now Cape Cod, Massachusetts, in November 1620. 41 of the pilgrims, so-called, all men, wrote and signed the compact. Invoking God's name and declaring themselves loyal subjects of the king, the signatories announced that they had journeyed to Northern Virginia, as the Eastern Seaboard of North America was called by the English until New England stuck as a name, and, quote, to plant the first colony, unquote, and did therefore, quote, covenant and combine ourselves together in a civil body politic, unquote, to be governed by just laws and equal laws enacted for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience. So this was the beginning of settler democracy, which from its inception sought the elimination of the indigenous. In other modern constitutional states, constitutions come and go, and I don't know of a single one that's considered sacred in the manner that patriotic U.S. citizens venerate theirs. Great Britain has no written constitution, never has, so U.S. citizens did not inherit their cult-like adherence to the Constitution from the English. From the Pilgrims to the founders of the United States and continuing to the present, the cultural persistence of the covenant idea, and thus the bedrock of U.S. patriotism, represents a deviation from the main course in the development of national identities. Historians and legal theorists characterize U.S. statecraft and empire as those of a nation of laws, rather than one determined by a particular class or group of interests, suggesting a kind of holiness. The U.S. Constitution, the Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, the writings of the Founding Fathers, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, the Pledge of Allegiance, which of course was only came about in the late 19th century, and even today Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, are all bundled into the covenant as sacred documents that express the U.S. state religion. An aspect of the most visible in the early 20th century is the burgeoning gun lobby, based on the sanctity of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. In the forefront of these Second Amendment adherents are the descendants of the old settlers who say that they represent, quote, the people and have the right to bear arms in order to overthrow any government that does not, in their view, adhere to the God-given covenant. Parallel to the idea of the U.S. Constitution as covenant, politicians, journalists, teachers, and even professional historians chant like a mantra that the United States is a nation of immigrants rather than being a settler state. From its beginning, the United States has welcomed, indeed often solicited and even bribed, immigrants to repopulate conquered territories cleansed of their indigenous inhabitants. From the mid-19th century, Irish immigrants fleeing famine were recruited to work mines, raise forests, construct canals and railroads, and labor in sweatshops, factories, and commercial farm fields. In the late 20th century, technical and medical workers have been recruited. The requirements for their citizenship are simple. Adhere to the sacred covenant through taking the citizenship oath, pledging loyalty to the flag and regarding those outside the covenant as enemies or potential enemies of the exceptional country that has adopted them, often after they have escaped hunger, war, or repression, which in turn were often caused by U.S. militarism or economic sanctions. Immigrants, to be accepted, must prove their fidelity to the covenant and what it stands for. And sadly for many, Thanksgiving seems to be an apolitical, unifying holiday and is most embraced. So how did this all begin? It didn't begin with 1620 and the Pilgrims. It had a dress rehearsal in Europe. And I call this culture of conquest. I know a lot of people may be allergic to Karl Marx, but no one ever said it better than he in The Genesis of the Industrial Capitalist in Capital. The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the Aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa, that's like Indonesia, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins signaled the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. These idyllic proceedings are the chief moments of prior accumulation of capital. So I do argue that the United States was founded as the first pure capitalist state, and it's fundamentally a corporation. So that's something, you know, a different kind of different way of looking at it that I urge you to think about. Well, the late anthropologist Edward H. Spicer wrote that the initial Europeans who participated in the colonization of the Americas were heirs to rich and ancient cultures, social relations, and customs in their lands of origin, whether Spain, France, Holland, or England. In the passage to the Americas and encountering the indigenous inhabitants, they largely abandoned the webs of European social relations. What each actually participated in was a culture of conquest, violence, expropriation, destruction, and dehumanization of themselves and their victims. Spicer's observation is true, but the culture of conquest didn't start with Europeans crossing the Atlantic. European institutions and the worldview of conquest and colonialism had formed several centuries before that. From the 11th through the 13th centuries, Europeans conducted the Crusades to conquer North Africa and the Middle East, leading to unprecedented wealth in the hands of a few. And of course, these were Muslim victims and Jewish. This profit-based religion was the deadly element that European merchants and settlers brought to the Americas and routinized. In the seeking of personal wealth, colonizers expressed a Christian zeal that justified colonialism. Along with that came the militaristic tradition that had also developed in Western Europe during the Crusades, which means literally carrying the cross. Although the popes, beginning with Urban II, called for most of the adventures, the crusading armies were mercenary outfits that promised the soldiers the right to seek and loot Muslim towns and cities, feats that would gain them wealth and prestige back home. Toward the end of the 13th century, that's the 1200s, the papacy began directing such mercenaries to crush domestic enemies in their midst as well, pagans and commoners in general, especially women as ostensible witches and heretics. In this way, knights and noblemen could seize land and force the commoners living on it into servitude. Historian Peter Limbaugh notes that whereas the anti-Muslim crusades were attempts to control the lucrative Muslim trade routes to the Far East, the domestic crusades in Europe against heretics and commoners were carried out to terrorize poor people and at the same time to enlist them in their lucrative and adventurous yet holy venture. Limbaugh writes, crusading was thus a murderous device to resolve a contradiction by bringing baron and commoner together in the cauldron of religious war. The first population forcibly organized under the profit motive, whose labor was exploited well before overseas exploitation was possible, was the European peasantry. Once forced off their lands, they had nothing to eat, nothing to sell but their labor. In addition, entire nations such as Scotland, Wales, Ireland, Bohemia, the Basque Country, and Catalonia, among others, were colonized and forced under the rule of various monarchies. The Moorish nation and the Sephardic Jewish minority were conquered and physically deported by the Castilian-Aragon monarchy from the Iberian Peninsula, a long-term project, 5 centuries, culminating in group expulsions beginning in 1492, the year that Columbus sailed to America. The institutions of colonialism and methods for relocation, depopulation, and expropriation of land had already been practiced, if not perfected, especially by the Spanish and the English, by the end of the 15th century. The rise of the modern state in Western Europe was based on the accumulation of wealth by means of exploiting human labor and displacing millions of subsistence producers from their land. And then there were a surplus of people. So when these states expanded overseas to obtain even more resources, land and labor, they were not starting anew. The peoples of the Caribbean, Central America, Mexico, and the Andes were the first overseas victims. And South Africa, North America, and the rest of South America followed. Then came all of Africa, the Pacific, and Asia, particularly South Asia. The sea voyages of European explorers and merchants in the late 15th and early 16th century were not the first of their kind. These voyages borrowed the techniques for long-distance sea travel from the Arab world. Before the Arabs ventured into the Indian Ocean, though, Inuits plied the Arctic Circle and their kayaks for centuries and made contacts and trade with many peoples, as did the Norse, South Asian, Chinese, Japanese, Peruvian, and Malaysian and Polynesian fishing peoples of the Pacific. Egyptian and Greek knowledge of the seas most likely extended beyond the Mediterranean into the Atlantic and Indian Oceans. Western European seagoing merchants and the monarchies that backed them would differ only in that they had developed the basis for colonial domination and exploitation of labor in those colonies and led to the capture and enslavement of millions of Native Americans and Africans to transport to the American colonies. Along with the cargo on European ships, especially of the late British colonizing ventures, came the emerging concept of land as private property. Esther King Manston, a specialist in land tenure history, has reconstructed the elevation of land as private property to sacred status in the 16th century in England. The English used the term enclosure to denote the privatization of the commons. During this time, peasants, who constituted a large majority of the population, were evicted from their ancient common lands. For centuries, the commons had been the pasture for milk cows and for running sheep and their source of water, wood, fuel, and construction, and edible and medicinal wild plants. Without these resources, they could not have survived as farmers, and they did not survive as farmers after they lost access to the commons. Not only were the commons privatized during the 16th and 17th century, they were also transformed into grazing lands rather than food production for commercial sheep production, wool being the main domestic and export commodity, creating wealth for a few and impoverishment for the many. Denied access to the former commons, rural subsistent farmers and even their children had no choice but to work in the new woolen textile factories under miserable conditions. That is, when they could find such work, for unemployment was high. Employed or not, this displaced and probably traumatized population was available to serve as settlers in the North American British colonies, many of them as indentured servants with the promise of land once they had served their contract time. After serving their terms of indenture, they were free to squat on indigenous land and become farmers again, have their own land. That's a powerful motive for immigration. In this way, surplus labor created not only low labor costs and great profits for the woolens manufacturers, but also a supply of settlers for the colonies, which was an escape valve in the home country where impoverishment could lead to uprisings of the exploited. The sacred status of property in the forms of land taken from indigenous farmers and of Africans as chattel pieces of property, commodities, was seeded into the drive for Anglo-American independence from Britain and the founding of the United States. So privatization of land was accompanied by an ideological drive to paint the commoners who resisted as violent, stupid, and lazy. The English Parliament, under the guise of fighting backwardness, criminalized former rights to the commons. Accompanying and facilitating the privatization of the commons was the suppression of women. As feminist theorist Sylvia Federici has argued, by conquering witchcraft. Those accused of witchcraft were poor peasants, women, often widows, while the accusers tended to be wealthier, either their landlords or their employers, individuals who controlled local institutions and had ties to the national government. Neighbors were encouraged to accuse one another of witchcraft. And witchcraft was considered mainly a female crime, especially at the peak of the witch hunts between 1550 and 1650, when more than 80% of those who were charged with witchcraft, tried, convicted, and executed were women. In England, those accused of witchcraft were mostly elderly women, often beggars, sometimes the wives of living laborers, but usually widows. Actions and local occurrences said to indicate witchcraft included non-payment of rent, that makes you a witch, demand for public assistance, that's still true, isn't it? I mean, giving the evil eye, of course, local die-offs of horses or other stock, and mysterious deaths of children blamed on witches. Also among the telltale actions were practices related to midwifery and any kind of contraception. The service that women provided among the poor as healers was one of the number of vestiges from pre-Christian matrilineal institutions that once dominated in Europe, as of course it did in the Americas before the colonizers. It is no surprise that those who had held on to and perpetuated these communal practices were those most resistant to the enclosure of the commons, the economic base of the peasantry, as well as women's autonomy. So these traumatized souls thrown off the land, as well as their descendants, became the land-hungry settlers enticed to cross a vast ocean with a promise of land and attaining the status of gentry. English settlers brought witch hunting with them to Jamestown, Virginia, and to Salem, Massachusetts. In language reminiscent of that to use to condemn witches, they quickly identified the indigenous populations as inherently children of Satan and servants of the devil who deserved to be killed. Later, the Salem authorities would justify witch trials by claiming that the English settlers were inhabiting land controlled by the devil. They had to kill them all off. Also part of the Christian colonizers' outlook was a deep white supremacy. Whiteness as an ideology involves much more than skin color, although skin color has been and continues to be a key component of racism in the United States. White supremacy can be traced to the colonizing ventures of the Christian Crusades in Muslim-controlled territories and to the Protestant colonization of Ireland. As dress rehearsals for the colonization of the Americas, these projects form the two strands that merge in the geographical and sociocultural makeup of U.S. society. The Crusades in the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal today, and the expulsion of Jews and Muslims were part of a process that created the core ideology of modern colonization, white supremacy, and its justification for genocide. The Crusades gave birth to the papal law of limpieza de sangre, cleanliness of blood, for which the Inquisition was established by the Church to investigate and determine. Before this time, the concept of biological race based on blood is not known to have existed as law or taboo in Christian Europe or anywhere else in the world. As scapegoating and suspicion of conversos, that is, Jews who had converted to Christianity, in those areas that the Christian conquered, they would force them to convert, and Moriscos, as the Muslims who converted to Christianity were called. So the persecution of these people, an investigation of their cleanliness of their blood, intensified over several centuries in Christian-controlled Spain. So the doctrine of cleanliness of blood was popularized. It had the effect of granting psychological, increasingly legal privileges to the old Christians, both rich and poor, thus obscuring the class differences between the landed aristocracy and land poor peasants and shepherds. So you see in England this attempt to solidify classes so that the lower classes saw themselves as a part of the upper class. Whatever the economic station, the old Christian Spanish were enabled to identify with the nobility. As one Spanish historian put it, the common people look upwards, wishing and hoping to climb, and let themselves be seduced by chivalric ideals of honor, dignity, glory, and the noble life. Lope de Vega, a 16th century contemporary of Cervantes, wrote, "I am a man, although of lowly status, yet clean of blood and with no mixture of Jewish or Moorish blood." This cross-class mindset can be found as well in the stance of the descendants of the old settlers of British colonization in North America. This, then, is the first instance of class leveling based on imagined racial sameness, the origin of white supremacy, the essential ideology of the colonial projects in America and Africa.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on the other side of Thanksgiving. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
As Elie Wiesel famously observed, the road to Auschwitz was paved in the earliest days of Christendom. Historian David Stannard in American Holocaust adds the caveat that that same road led straight through the heart of America. The ideology of white supremacy was paramount in neutralizing the class antagonisms of the landless against the landed and distributing confiscated lands and properties of the Moors and Jews in Iberia, of the Irish in Ulster, and of Native American and African peoples. So Great Britain, emerging as an overseas colonial power century after Spain did, absorbed aspects of the Spanish racial caste system, which had 32 degrees of bloodlines from white to pure Indian in the Americas. Africans were a little bit above, even in slavery, a little bit above the Indians. But it did so within the context of Protestantism, which imagined a chosen people founding and raising a new Jerusalem. The English did not just adapt the habits and experiences of Spanish colonization. They had their own prior experience, which actually constituted overseas imperialism. During the early 17th century, the English conquered Ireland, another continent, another island, and declared a 500,000 acres of land in the north open to settlement. The settlers who served early settler colonialism came mostly from western Scotland. England had previously conquered Wales and Scotland, but it had never before attempted to remove so large an indigenous population and plant settlers in their place as in Ireland. The ancient Irish social system was systematically attacked, traditional songs and music forbidden, the language forbidden, whole clans exterminated, and the remainder brutalized. A, quote, wild Irish reserve was even attempted. The plantation of Ulster, as it was called, was as much a culmination of as it was a departure from centuries of intermittent warfare in Ireland. In the 16th century, the official in charge of the Irish province of Munster, Sir Humphrey Gilbert, was then also used early in the colonization of New England. The English government paid bounties for Irish heads. Later, only the scalps or ears were required. A century later in North America, Indian heads and scalps were brought for bounty. In the same manner, although the Irish were as white as the English, if you look at skin color, transforming them into alien others to be exterminated previewed what came to be perceived as racialist when applied to indigenous peoples of North America and to Africans. At that conjuncture, both in the Christian Crusades against the Muslims and England's invasion of Ireland, the transition from religious wars to the genocidal mode of colonialism is apparent. The Irish, under British colonial rule well into the 20th century and continuing, continued to be regarded as biologically inferior. During the mid-19th century, influenced by social Darwinism, some English scientists peddled the theory that the Irish, and all people of color, had descended from apes, while the English were descendants of man who had been created by God in his own image. Thus the English were angels, and the Irish and other colonized peoples were a lower species, which today U.S. Christian identity white supremacists call mud people, inferior products of the process of evolution. The same Sir Humphrey Gilbert, who had been in charge of the colonization of Ulster, planted the first English colonial settlement in North America in Newfoundland in the summer of 1852, continuing the practices he introduced in Ireland. In the lead-up to the formation of the United States, Protestantism uniquely refined white supremacy as part of a political religious ideology. So I want to stop there, so we have Q&A, but I would, you know, if you want to bring up the question of genocide or depopulation of the early colony, I would be glad to talk about it. But I'll just say one thing about that, that when we talk about genocide, we tend to automatically embrace what some Native scholars have started calling a terminal narrative, that is, that Native people no longer existed. And of course, in the case of the Jewish Holocaust, no one denies that more Jews died of starvation, overwork, and disease under Nazi incarceration than they died in gas ovens. Yet the acts of creating and maintaining the conditions that led to those deaths clearly constitute genocide. But also no one questions that there are still Jewish people. They weren't all wiped out. There's still Armenians, there's still Cambodians, but when it comes to Native Americans, there's this erasure. I was asked in an interview just this morning on the telephone, what led to the disappearance of the Native people? So I had to say, they're still here. Still here. What if archaeologists and anthropologists and historians were asked to explain the continued presence of descendant communities 500 years after Columbus instead of their disappearance or marginality? Accounts of Indian histories which explain the absence, cultural death, or disappearance of the indigenous peoples. So thank you.
You touched on Thanksgiving and how it's kind of this fairy tale told to like soothe everyone's consciousness about events that actually happened. And I'm just wondering what your recommendation is for, you know, as we go into the holidays, what are the steps we can take to kind of make it maybe more of, as you mentioned, a day of mourning as opposed to celebration?
Well, I think of it as like the Irish wake, you know, where you can honor death without being totally glum. You can also tell positive stories about Native resistance to brutality. Native people would not be here today had they not resisted endlessly across the continent and telling their stories. And so it's, for me anyway, learning, I grew up in a, you know, in a white county of that was of settlers in Oklahoma, mostly landless ones like my father, but it was the old, you know, Southern Cheyenne Arapaho territory reservation that was allotted. And over the past 40 years, teaching Native American studies and being in many Native nations here and in Canada, I've heard these stories, and they're very inspiring. Native people have survival skills. A lot of that has to do with telling stories. So the stories you choose to tell and to inspire people, instead of George Washington, why not Sitting Bull or Tecumseh? It can belong to everyone. You know, everyone can admire and feel, this is the real America. This is the real, you know, person that I'm going to admire, instead of George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, slave owners and Indian killers. I'm going to admire real heroes of this nation, you know, the indigenous peoples. So it can belong to everyone. So I think just talking about it and talking about the story of, you know, how these people regarded the indigenous people as a devil incarnate, just logically, would they really be sitting down for Thanksgiving dinner with people they consider the devil? these true believers? I don't think so. If there were any Native people there, they would probably have been enslaved and were serving. So this happy story of, you know, sharing the food, but that food that's eaten at Thanksgiving is indeed, these are the squash and the pumpkins and the corn and the green beans and the sweet potatoes and potatoes. These were all creations of Native civilizations in the Americas long before the Europeans came. And then, of course, in other areas here, the salmon, the people of the salmon, the turkeys, and, you know, the wild turkeys all over the continent, different kinds of fowl and how they're prepared. Just thinking about these foods, if you trace, just look on Wikipedia, where did corn come from? Where you get the whole history of the food you're eating, and it tells you Native history.
From an early age, we are learned the different stories than the truth. How can that change?
I find, you know, that there's a kind of receptiveness to, you know, thinking of a different framework for U.S. history, that somehow it does, you know, it doesn't add up and make sense. And I think it's why kids hate history so much in the United States, is because, you know, kids can kind of, they don't know how to explain it, but it just sounds phony, you know. I remember Washington cutting down that cherry tree, you know, that just, I don't know. You know, well, they dropped that, but there's still, you know, book after book after book, you know, comes out with this sort of idealistic. And the most historians, and it is my field, I have a doctorate in history, they like to say, oh, well, we're going to do something with warts and all, you know, a history of something or other with warts and all, or Jackson with warts and all. But, you know, it's not just warts, it's the core. It's the very core of colonization.
What are the prospects for getting this kind of information into the mainstream textbooks?
Well, textbooks under capitalism. It's, you know, whatever sells and school boards decide, and our horrible fate is, and I'm not sure all the steps that led to this, but that somehow the Texas school boards are identified by textbook publishers as, you know, whatever they go with is what they will publish. So that's then all that's available to other schools across the country. Famously, you know, back in the 50s with the John Birch Society and continuing, and we could think of doing this ourselves, they burrowed into school districts all over the country, right-wingers did. So now they virtually control, you know, most of the country, not in San Francisco where I live, but in many places. And so when new standards come out, when there's attempt, like when Gary Nash, who was one of my professors at UCLA when I was in graduate school, when he was put in charge of the national new standards under Clinton, oh, there was such an uproar that he even, you know, said one good thing about Native Americans, you know, or one critical thing at all about the English settlers occupying the land of the Wampanoag Nation. And then there was, you know, the Newt Gingrich's, when they took over Congress in 1994, is what you have to look forward to now. Newt Gingrich, who was the Speaker of the House, hired a new historian, a woman from Georgia, and she objected to the standards because they didn't give the Ku Klux Klan equal space to the civil rights movement. I'm not kidding, this is a fact. She was asked to resign because it was a little beyond the pale. But that is the thinking, you know. If you say one good thing about civil rights, you've got to defend the Southern so-called point of view toward that same thing. So you're supposed to have this balance. And this is very confusing to kids because, you know, it's just not true. When I was first teaching Native American studies in the early 70s, we didn't have many materials at all, especially history, to use. And I would use some texts that were really bad and teach against the text. So, you know, teachers can be subversive, and they do often get fired these days, but if they are, and that's why teachers' tenure is very important, everyone. And labor unions. So, you know, we're really weakening on that front. I think it's almost a consensus now that, you know, for charter schools and the unions are the enemy and teachers are horrible and are, you know, they're the scapegoat for our poor education system and poor outcomes. And it only gets worse when it's all based on testing. So, you know, parents have a lot to do with, PTAs have a lot to do with school boards. And if they want their children to grow up misinformed, well, here's another alternative they could look at, you know, and say, why not teach this at Thanksgiving? And the situation for Native people can only change so much by their own efforts. And their own efforts are 24/7. All the young people who get educated, they are expected to come back and work on these things. And a lot has been done, you know, since the movement, you know, the Renaissance, the movement in the 50s and continuing, and the international work, which I haven't even talked about, getting the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples at the UN in 2007. But it's going to take large numbers of ordinary people supporting it for their own good, not to do a favor to the Native people, because included in that package is stop exploiting the resources. The Keystone Pipeline, is connected with the tar sands in Manitoba, which is ruining Native people's land there. So it ties into very important climate change, the Arctic people, ice is melting from industrialization. So it's in everyone's interest to support Native people getting back control as much territory as is possible.
I was wondering about Black Friday as another part of Thanksgiving, and how would that tie in, and would boycotting that maybe like bring more awareness somehow?
That's a whole other thing, you know, that the minimum wage people at Walmart's and all the fast food places and all have chosen, especially Walmart, have chosen Black Friday to call for boycott of shopping in solidarity. And then there's the Church of Stop Shopping. I don't know if you know that. That's a very funny guy who says, just stop shopping anytime. Stop being a consumer. I support Black Friday, but it's not really tied. And I don't think anyone, you know, calls for a boycott of Thanksgiving, but a change of the name, you know, to keep the holiday, but make it a wake, if you will, for all the Native people who were murdered, massacred, killed to take their land, and to also talk about the present day and what could be done. There are treaties, agreements, there's land that was confiscated outside of treaties. There's about 100 million acres of land. Native people aren't saying everyone has to leave. Most of the land that was taken illegally outside of treaties is actually under federal control or state control. National parks, national forests, national monuments, the Bureau of Land Management, especially west of the Mississippi, like 80% of the land in New Mexico is either federal or state land. And by executive order, that could be signed back over to the Native people. And the sacred sites that were taken mostly under Theodore Roosevelt without permission, like the Yosemite and Yellowstone and Grand Canyon, other parks, you know, Native Americans should be stewards of these places, should be the ones who are stewards of it, and they should be restored. One sacred site was restored in 1973, the sacred Blue Lake of Taos Pueblo. So there is a precedent for that kind of restoration of sacred sites, and there's even a national law of the protection of Native religion. So there's, you know, the Great Sioux Nation, their treaty of 1868. The Great Sioux Nation was this large contiguous territory, one people, with most of North and South Dakota, much of Montana, Minnesota, Nebraska, and down to Kansas. And it's the, you know, and the whole Missouri River at the top. And this land was taken it's now 9 separate, distinct, it looks, you know, it's little tiny islands divided by different groups of Sioux Lakota people. And before that, you know, even before that, an allotment, the Black Hills, the sacred Black Hills, were taken by Custer, before the Battle of Little Bighorn, of course. And that's one reason why the Native people gathered together and destroyed the 7th Cavalry and Custer, is they just, you know, they went up into the hills and started doing gold digging and discovered gold, and it brought a gold rush. And so the United States just annexed the Black Hills without any kind of treaty, any kind of discussion. And they admitted this. I tell this whole story in the book. In 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court finally said this land was illegally taken, and so pay off, you know, cash payment. So something like $1.5 million, a paltry sum of money for this vast territory, was offered to the Sioux. But they wouldn't have taken any amount. And they are the poorest people in the whole hemisphere. Pine Ridge is the single most poorest community in the whole hemisphere. And now that is in a trust fund that's gone up to $1.5 billion, and they still won't take it. So you can see how important that sacred land is. It's not for sale. I've learned these stories, you know, I have a doctorate in history. I actually did Latin American history and did my dissertation on New Mexico as a Spanish colony. And then I added to it, you know, the two different colonizations in the Southwest. There really was nothing, you know, that could be called a U.S. history, all the U.S. history books that are written. I've looked at a lot of them, the textbooks and all, and they're pretty much like Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, you know, where they do this terminal narrative, and some do it better than others, but it leaves the impression, and it's kind of a soothing one, you know, this tragedy. They're just all gone. Then no one has to worry anymore. Communities don't forget these Jewish conversos, that one way to get out of Spain and not get persecuted by the Inquisition was to go on a colonizing venture. So many of these people in the last, you know, in the last 50 years or so have come out with their stories of being, it has a weird designation, cryptic Jews, that is, they were conversos, but they had kept up their practices, you know, their religious practices, even here in the colonies, and especially Argentina and quite a few in New Mexico. So people don't easily forget their, you know, their sources. And so a lot in east of the Mississippi that was ethnically cleansed under Andrew Jackson in the 1830s and 40s and removed to Oklahoma, to Indian Territory, which is now Oklahoma, they were not all rounded up. They could not round up everyone. So all of these Native people east of the Mississippi are reconstituting themselves. So you have Eastern Cherokee Nation now, and you have the Western Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, and they have ties with each other, with the Choctaw and the Chickasaw and all. So that's all just taken place, you know, in the last 40 years or so. So there's a tremendous amount of change that's taken place kind of under the radar for most people. They don't even know that this is going on or has taken place, and that there are, you know, all these networks, and isn't that hard to tap into and learn. And it's the very best way to learn is, you know, from the Native people in the area.
Let's give our great thanks. Thank you.
That was Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on the other side of Thanksgiving. She spoke at Fairhaven College in Bellingham, Washington. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is the author of the award-winning An Indigenous People's History of the United States. She's internationally recognized as an expert on the indigenous peoples of the Americas. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We offer our weekly program free of charge to all public and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, and beyond. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard elsewhere, such as Russell Means, Cornel West, Naomi Klein, Juan Gonzalez, Winona LaDuke, Chris Hedges, Michelle Alexander, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, On the Other Side of Thanksgiving, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Taylor Sanders recorded the program. Our theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.